From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, on one of the coldest nights of the season, the city takes its annual homeless census.
They're very resilient, and they try to protect themselves, even though we know that they're vulnerable, and do everything we can to bring them inside.
Also today, should Facebook really be monitoring users for suicidal behavior?
The question is, when these things that are watching and listening start to make algorithms about how best to take care of us from a health perspective, somebody needs to regulate them so that they do good.
And Still Gold on their latest album, The New Normal.
We're in a highly, politicized climate that's like completely divided, and so if you're talking about what it means to live in that life, then you're making a political record.
It's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. It's the thing that's on everyone's minds.
The dreaded polar vortex moves south. Parts of 16 states will see temperatures below zero and wind chills that make it feel a lot colder.
Nearly 90 million Americans are now in the grip of dangerous cold as the polar vortex spreads across more of the country.
The polar vortex bringing the cold south with record-breaking temperatures in the Midwest. And here in Boston, we're in the teens with wind chills below zero. So the polar vortex, what is it and how long can we expect it to last? Well, hopefully joining me with some answers is Alan Dunham from the National Weather Service in Norton. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Jamie. How are you?
Good. How are you? So you're a meteorologist. We've been hearing this all week. What is this polar vortex?
Basically, it's just Arctic air that's been a piece of it broke off, and basically the jet stream brought it right down into Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, and it's now starting to slowly lift out. Now what we get is we get a glancing blow because the air modifies a lot before it reached us. So instead of getting the 20 to 30 below zero temperatures without the wind, we only had low temperatures, mostly in the single digits below zero last night.
So when you say it broke off, what do you mean by that?
Just a piece of it. The real cold air, normally that gets kept up north with the jet, the jet stream blocks it off.
Mm-hmm.
This time we had a jet stream that was diving almost due south and was able to drag that piece of the polar vortex right on top of us. That's super cold air.
So how often does this happen? Because, I mean, it's January in New England, so why is this happening now?
Actually, it's just the way it's set up. Actually, Boston itself, been doing a little checking of back temperatures, and mostly we hit 5 degrees or colder 3 times every winter. So the fact that we got down to 5 in Boston last night is not that real unusual. Mm-hmm. To us, it's, unusual winter, whereas out in the upper Midwest, that's been historic.
Right, right. Those below zero temperatures out there, we've, even seen reports of people dying. So I'm curious how you're seeing this affect different areas of the country.
Well, we're doing is, we mainly concentrate on southern New England.
Mm-hmm.
We look at see what's happening upstream, and it's of interest to us. But our main concern is southern New England and the fact that we're being very thankful that we're not getting that cold. And the good news is it's not going to be lasting long.
Oh, as in summer is eventually going to come, or is there actually immediate good news in the forecast?
Actually, we're going on a bit of a roller coaster, to be honest. We'll start seeing a slight slow warm-up tomorrow with highs getting up into the low 20s. Then by Sunday, highs be up into the mid-30s. And by the time we get to Tuesday, high temperatures will be in the mid to upper 50s with a few locations and maybe getting as high as 60 degrees.
60 degrees. February. This is New England weather. Wow. Okay. Well, Alan Dunham, meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Norton. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Now, as the temperatures drop outside, we know that some of the most vulnerable people are those without homes. Last night, as part of the city's annual homeless census, hundreds of volunteers and public officials braved the cold to see how many people were spending the night on the streets and offer them shelter and services. Now, the numbers aren't in yet, but according to last year's census, there are more than 6,000 people without homes in Boston, with more than 150 people living on the street. Robert Polster is the regional coordinator with the National Initiatives Team at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and he was among those out there last night for the count, and he joins me now on the line. Hello, Robert.
Hi there. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us about last night. It was bitter cold, as we've heard, and the country's gripped in this bitter cold, but what did you see and hear from the folks out there?
Well, you know, last night was bitterly cold, as you know, and the team met at City Hall under the leadership of Mayor Walsh, who's been a tremendous support for the efforts around homelessness in the city. And we fanned out in neighborhoods all across the city at about 10 o'clock. And I was with the mayor and his team around Downtown Crossing, Washington Street area. And, you know, most folks last night were inside, so that was a good thing that they did take advantage of the city's very open and accessible shelter system.
Mm-hmm.
But we did find some folks outside, particularly congregated around establishments, stores, 7-Elevens, McDonald's, that would allow them to kind of go in and out so they could take advantage of some heat when they needed it. And we did see many folks that we talked to, with the mayor's encouragement, decided to hop in the van and head to one of the city shelters. So that was a good thing. People were obviously cold and concerned for their safety, so, you know, with some encouragement from the team, they did decide to jump in the van and get some relief. There were some folks, however, who chose to stay outside.
Yeah, and what were some of their reasons?
Well, there are obviously many reasons, but, you know, a lot of times some folks have had negative experiences in shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very resilient, and they find ways to manage even on a cold night by using places where they can find heat. Obviously, there's people who, because of severe mental illness or substance use, also opt not to come inside. So we take special care to make sure we're engaging those folks and getting them in a place where they can be safe.
So we see frigid temperatures every winter in Boston, as our meteorologist told us a little earlier. You know, there are at least 3 days per year that get really cold. But in general, it's New England. It's winter in Boston. It gets cold.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we reduce the number of people on the streets each winter?
Right. Well, you know, Boston has one of the best in the country street outreach teams and a robust services available for folks that are experiencing homelessness. So there are street outreach teams always available each day, each night in the city that engage people who can be reluctant to come inside. So there's always an effort made on any night, warm nights, cold nights, to bring people inside. Obviously becomes a particular concern when we have a bitter cold night like last night. And the other thing is, you know, and Boston is leading the way on this through its Boston's Way Home campaign, is that the solution to homelessness is housing.
Right.
And to the extent that we have the resources available and the collaboration of many agencies that can get folks not only into shelter but quickly exit them from shelter into housing is where we put a lot of our resources and energy right now, is making housing as accessible as possible. This is what we know as housing first. So, you know, the city is the beneficiary of funding from HUD. Just recently, last month, they were awarded over $26 million, which is about 37% of the $71 million that came into Massachusetts from HUD, which supports the continuum of care program. So there's money in housing support, housing and support services, but obviously we need to continue to add money to have the housing stock, the affordable housing, the vouchers that we need to bring everyone inside as quickly as possible.
Right, so much more work to be done. Robert Polster is the regional coordinator with the National Initiatives Team at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Since President Trump's election in 2016, many left-leaning political leaders here in Massachusetts like to think of the state as the heart of the resistance, pushing for so-called sanctuary city status or calling on universities to end contracts with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. But as WBUR's Shannon Dooling has been reporting here, some could be surprised to learn that Massachusetts sheriffs are quietly using their jails for a long-standing practice of housing undocumented immigrants for ICE, and they're bringing millions of dollars into state coffers. And she joins me now in studio. Hi, Shannon Dooling.
Hi, Jamie.
So these contracts with ICE, what are they and how long have they been in place?
Right. So just the basics. We have four county sheriffs here that contract with the Department of Homeland Security to house ICE inmates. Those are Bristol, Franklin, Plymouth, and Suffolk County sheriffs. Suffolk's contract actually dates all the way back to 2003.
Wow.
Yeah. So it is longstanding, as you mentioned. These county sheriffs are holding federal ICE detainees in their facilities. So these are places where state inmates serve short sentences or maybe they're awaiting trial. And these ICE detainees could be undocumented immigrants who have no criminal charges but are in removal procedures. So the government is trying to have them deported. Or the ICE inmates could also be immigrant detainees who do have criminal charges and are also awaiting deportation. Now, usually they're people who've lived in local communities here in Massachusetts, but it's also possible for ICE to transfer detainees to Massachusetts sheriff's offices from other parts of the country. So there are contracts for housing services, for transportation, in some cases medical care, some office space that's rented by ICE. And what we're looking at here are the housing contracts. So we asked for invoices for fiscal year 2017 and 2018. So the amount of money the federal government is paying to house the inmates in local facilities.
So got it. So just looking at the housing
just
contracts.
Just housing, yep.
And so the amount that these counties get reimbursed to hold these inmates, how much are we talking about?
Right. So in those 2 years combined, the state brought in almost $40 million for housing federal ICE detainees at those four county jails. Now, it's important to note that up until 2016, that money stayed at the county sheriff's office. So they were reimbursed directly by the federal government. But that changed in 2016, and the money was rerouted into the state's general fund. That's this large pool of money that funds everything from education to transportation.
Right. So I guess what we're talking about here is this longstanding policy. Mm-hmm. It's a shift in where the money is going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But do we know if the state itself is actually making a profit on these contracts, or is the $40 million going toward covering the expenses,
right,
breaking even, maybe losing money?
Well, that is a great question, Jamie. And frustratingly enough, you know, we've been asking that question of the state. We asked the individual sheriffs. The short answer is no, we don't know. To be honest, it doesn't seem like the state knows either. We asked the Executive Office for Administration and Finance that exact question, and that question was never addressed. Mm. We also asked the individual sheriff's offices, including Sheriff Thomas Hodgson at Bristol County. So listeners may remember that Hodgson is the sheriff who helped start a crowdfunding campaign to build President Trump's border wall. He also offered to send county
right.
inmates to the border to help with the construction of the wall. Let's take a listen to what Sheriff Hodgson has to say.
We're more interested in making sure that whatever monies are coming in, that our costs are covered, and that whatever, if there's any additional monies, that it's reinvested either in infrastructure upgrades or things like that. But we don't control it anymore. The state does.
Right. So they don't control it anymore. The state does. So after months of this sort of back and forth, we decided to do our own analysis. So what we looked at was how much each of these sheriffs charged ICE during those 2 years compared to what each of the sheriffs reported spending on operating expenses.
Okay.
So this isn't exactly an apples to apples scientific way of looking at it, but it's one of the best things we could figure to do.
Money in, money out.
Yeah. So for comparison's sake, here are some of the results. The money Bristol County charged was a total of almost $12.6 million over those 2 years. And that actually surpassed the sheriff's operating expenses by more than $1.5 million. Again, that's not to say that Bristol profited that $1.5 million because employee wages, pensions, expenses like that still need to be accounted for. But the money charged to ICE, at the very least, covered the operating expenses and then some. And in Franklin and Plymouth County sheriff's offices, housing the ICE detainees accounted for more than half of their respective operating budgets.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So, we're talking about big money.
Right. It's not insignificant.
No. And so I'm curious what else stood out to you in your reporting about this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, first was the fact that no one could tell us whether we're profiting or losing money or breaking even. But besides that, we were able to get the daily rates that each sheriff charges ICE. And so those range from $98 a day per ICE inmate at Bristol County to $90 a day per ICE inmate at Suffolk County. We asked State Representative Antonio Cabral from New Bedford, which of course falls in Bristol County, if he had any insight into whether the state sees any net profits off these contracts with ICE.
I'm not sure if we are making money off the ICE detainees. I think it actually would be a good analysis. It's one that I have never been able to see, is an analysis of how much it costs to provide the service to each detainee, and does the $90 or the $99 cover for that cost?
So again, we asked that question of the sheriffs. Look, we know how much you charge ICE a day per detainee, but how much are you actually spending per detainee?
And what did they tell you?
Well, Bristol County actually was the only sheriff to get back to us on that. They estimate an average cost of $88 a day to house an inmate. So that's compared to that $98 a day that they're charging ICE. But each of the sheriff's offices told us, I should say each of the other three sheriff's offices told us that they don't keep track of that daily cost per inmate, or at the least they didn't have corresponding records to provide us. But interestingly, Jamie, all of this comes in the context of statewide declines in overall inmate populations, about a 21% drop in the last 7 or 8 years.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah. So tell me what that means practically speaking. Like, is the state using this money to fill the gap in that decline in income from declining inmate populations? Is that what changed in 2016?
Or? Well, it's unclear if that's what prompted the change in 2016, but I did ask Ben Foreman at Mass Inc., which is a research and policy nonprofit here, to help provide a little context around the numbers.
As our populations have declined in our correctional facilities, there's been beds to fill in order to keep people employed. One of the questions for us is, would we rather close these facilities and find other employment for correctional officers?
Or, Foreman says, do we keep filling these empty beds with ICE inmates?
So Shannon, I do want to get back to something I mentioned up at the top, which is that, you know, so many Massachusetts towns and politicians sort of priding themselves in their resistance to some of the administration's immigration policies. What are you hearing from them on this, you know, now that this is all out there because of your reporting?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, of course, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has been very vocal about Boston being a sanctuary city. We did some reporting last year on this trend across the state where more and more communities were reaching out to the ACLU of Massachusetts to learn how they could establish sanctuary policies. But I mean, ultimately, the sheriffs are independent entities, right? And the sheriffs themselves are elected officials. So they're within their purview to enter into contracts like this with the federal government, even in a state that recently elected Ayanna Pressley to Congress, who you'll remember has called for the abolishment of ICE.
Right. That was part of her campaign platform. Well, WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and you're listening to Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Pretty much every time you log on to your computer or unlock your phone screen, some major corporation is probably keeping very close track of you. Google, Amazon, and of course, Facebook. Now, most of us already know this, but what we've been learning is that Facebook is combing our data looking for signs of suicidal behavior. The company analyzes comments, posts, and videos to see if someone is thinking about taking their own life. And in thousands of cases, Facebook has notified police, who in turn have arrived to perform wellness checks. But how do we weigh the cost to privacy and the consequences of a false identification against possible social good of saving a life? Well, joining me now to discuss more is Dr. Mason Marks. He's a research scholar at NYU's Information Law Institute and a visiting fellow at the Yale Law School's Information Society Project. He's been following this topic closely. Dr. Marks, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jamie. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us is Hiawatha Bray, Boston Globe technology writer. Hello, Hiawatha.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thanks for doing it. And on the line, we have Dr. Steve Schlossman. He's co-director of the Clay Center for Youth Healthy Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital, where he practices child and adult psychiatry. Dr. Schlossman, thanks and hello to you as well.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Thanks. So, Dr. Marks, I want to start with you. What do we know about how Facebook's algorithm evaluates whether someone is a suicide risk?
So I just want to start out first by pointing out that suicide is a very serious problem. It's a growing problem. Suicide rates have been increasing steadily for the past 10 years or 20 years.
Yeah.
And
it's the second leading cause of death among people ages 15 to 29 worldwide.
Right. It now kills more people than auto accidents in the U.S., and we pay a lot of attention to auto safety. There are a lot of regulations regarding motor vehicles, but relatively little preventing suicide. So I just want to say that it's really important to be doing this. And
right.
In principle, I don't disagree that this should be done, but it's more the way that Facebook is going about doing it. And right now we know very little about how the company makes these predictions. They provided a little bit of information. We know that they trained their artificial intelligence algorithms based on user comments and user reports about concerning comments. So a friend or a family member might see that someone posts something that is cause for concern, and they notify Facebook's
content moderators. So they click the little report button?
Right, exactly. And so that information gets incorporated into the algorithm, and they use that to train the algorithm and then to make a prediction, which is basically a score that ranges from 0 to 1, and a score that's closer to 1 is said by Facebook to represent a higher risk of suicide. The problem is, though, that it sounds like, based on the information that Facebook has provided, they're making these determinations based on internal data. So it's not based on actual suicide-related deaths, because Facebook doesn't have access to medical records. There's a whole separate path of suicide prediction being done within the healthcare system, where doctors like doctors Colin Walsh at Vanderbilt University, for example, has access to millions of medical records or hundreds of thousands of medical records. So they can actually train their algorithms on real suicide data.
Right.
In comparison, Facebook doesn't have access to that information, so they're using proxies for suicidal thought and for attempted suicide. And that's what's most concerning. There's a lack of transparency, and because of that, we don't know whether the system they're using is safe or effective.
So Facebook acting as a healthcare provider, Hiawatha Bray, technology writer at The Globe, does that concern you?
Well, yes, it does. And you can see that they have legitimate reasons for being concerned. I mean, I don't want to jump down Facebook's throat and start screaming it's 1984 and all. Think about it from their point of view. This is a company that has made a big move into video with Facebook Live. And one of the things that kicked this whole thing off was cases in which people would actually live stream their own suicides mm-hmm. as they were committing them. This is something that Facebook really does have to think about, and so you can't blame them for trying to find a solution. But there are all kinds of problems that this raises, and it also serves to highlight the larger issue, as if, believe it or not, there is a larger issue here, which is they're collecting vast amounts of data and on their own, unilaterally, deciding what they're going to do with it in an effort to influence our behavior. They're going to reach into the real world now and start trying to change what we do. It might make sense in this case, but how far do they take it? What limits are there to what Facebook thinks it's entitled to do in terms of trying to change what we do? This is a potentially very useful thing, but it's going to have to be hedged around with some considerable caution.
But and I agree with you on the caution piece, but I'm also curious, Dr. Schlossman from Mass General, using machine learning to assess a risk and then flagging first responders and letting them do what they're trained to do in these cases, helping someone in need of help in a crisis, isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, this is all about the context. So I agree with what everyone has said so far. It's incredibly useful to take advantage of all that big data has to offer to better predict what's already a really, really difficult thing to predict, which is whether or not a patient is at risk to take their own life. Given the relatively high number of people who think about taking their own lives and never do anything about it. So in theory, you know, you could say, well, this isn't that different from, say, in a classroom where mm-hmm. a bunch of teachers notice that a particular child is behaving differently than they normally do, say a particular teenager. They don't even think that maybe this child is at risk for hurting themselves, but it's a different enough behavior that they report it to the school counselor. Then the school counselor brings the kid in and does a more expert-led screening and evaluation, so it goes from the screening to the evaluation stage. All of that makes sense. My problem with this, what worries me so much about it, why I enjoyed the piece in The Guardian so much that was referenced, is this is a multi-million dollar for-profit company that's actually keeping the way they're doing this somewhat secretive. And that, first of all, kind of cuts out the mental health clinicians from the evaluative process. And also it makes me worry about the possibility that we would cross too far over that very thin line that separates civil liberties from the need to take care of folks who are becoming psychiatrically ill.
But hasn't mental health care frequently bumped up against civil liberties? I'm thinking about involuntary commitments in particular.
Oh, always. No, we always do, and we never take it lightly, and that's exactly why I have this concern. I mean, it is a very strange feeling to sign a piece of paper that allows somebody's civil liberties to be kind of worked around to bring them into the emergency room for an evaluation against their will. It's something you do because we've decided as a society, and I believe in this, that it's safer than letting folks who are at significant risk go ahead and potentially hurt themselves. We'd rather err on the side of safety. But we're well aware that this is a very, very thin tightrope that we're walking all the time. And because of that, I would much rather there be fairly intense regulatory oversight over any initiative that endeavors to screen for this already difficult thing to predict.
Now, Hiawatha Bray, it sounded like you wanted to say something.
No, I'm
there.
Sorry. I wanted to hear it because this is just fascinating. I have had a chance to look at Dr. Marks's paper, the one that he's got in development. He talks about a really important aspect of this. Are you going to call the police to come to somebody's house and investigate that person based on an algorithm that the police and no other government agency has any access to? That raises some really interesting problems in terms of constitutional rights. If somebody's coming to your door and the police are about to intervene in your life, they should have to show some kind of cause to do it. And just saying, a computer told us you were about to kill yourself, doesn't strike me as enough of a reason, unless there's some oversight as to what that computer's doing. And this is part of the whole larger issue of how, in so many areas of our lives, including things like how long we sentence people to prison, what kind of bail arrangements they get, whether they get probation. Increasingly, these decisions are being put in the hands of algorithms.
Right.
Algorithms that the public has no access to. And that's something we really
and private
need to
corporations.
Start thinking about. Yeah, that's right. Private corporations. That's right.
And Dr. Mason Marks, your paper has been cited now a number of times, and I just want to let our listeners know that we have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. But I do want to bring you back into this conversation because I'm curious to hear what you think of what you're hearing from Hiawatha and Dr. Schlossman.
Those are all great points that were raised. And I think it's important to talk a little bit about the accuracy. So predicting suicide is an extremely complex problem. When you think about it, deciding to end someone's life, their own life, is probably the most profound decision a person could ever make. And to think that we'd be able to predict that with an algorithm is a little bit arrogant because there are just so many different risk factors. And oftentimes people attempt suicide impulsively. They have no history of mental illness. So it shouldn't be surprising. This is a very, very difficult thing to predict. It might not really be possible to do it with very high accuracy. And the current state of the art, even with AI, is still not very high. Some of the people that are doing it on the medical side get accuracy in the range of like 60 to 80%, depending on the conditions. We don't know the accuracy of Facebook's algorithms, and that's really a problem. Because like Hiawatha said, Facebook is calling police, actually helping police to locate
people's homes based on data on Facebook. And there's something, you know, the Fourth Amendment in the U.S. protects people from warrantless searches, but there's something called the exigent circumstances exception, which allows police to enter someone's homes without a warrant if they believe there's a reasonable risk of bodily injury. The problem is that police are basing that decision on what Facebook tells them, and we don't know anything about that. And we already know that there are certain vulnerable populations that are most susceptible to suicide. There are some. Facebook's not the only company that's doing this, by the way. There's a nonprofit company in New York called Crisis Text Line that does this based on texts. And we know they're very proud of that they serve largely vulnerable populations like minorities, like Hispanics, the LGBT community. So these people are already, they might be somewhat marginalized, somewhat vulnerable to police attention already. And then their homes are being searched based on this sort of black box algorithm that we don't know anything about.
But Dr. Marks, if I may, we reached out to Facebook for a comment and they have not yet responded. But they did say in the New York Times in December that, you know, while their efforts are not perfect, they decided to err on the side of providing people who need help with resources as soon as possible. And to that point, I'm curious if we know, we don't know how this black box works, but if we know how successful this program has been.
Yeah, we don't know that either. We really don't have any information about how the algorithm was trained, how the humans involved in the process make decisions, what training they have. We don't know what kind of licenses or certifications, if any, they have. We don't know what information they're providing to the police. And we don't know any information about the outcomes. I've argued before that not only is this practice similar to the practice of medicine and that Facebook and other companies are taking on the role of a healthcare provider, but also that this technology that they're using can be thought of as a medical device. And their, you know, software can be a medical device. It can be regulated by the FDA. But when we introduce a medical device into the marketplace, there's some testing or there has to be some assurances made that the device is comparable to a device that's already been approved. But in this case, we just don't have any of that information about safety and about effectiveness. Okay. So there are a lot of risks. They're not just risks to people's civil liberties. There are privacy risks. The suicide prediction information could be bought and sold to data brokers, for example, to advertisers, potentially even to employers and insurance companies who might discriminate against people based on those predictions, which may be inaccurate.
Right. Well, I did want to turn to Hiawatha Bray here about that and ask if, you know, beyond Facebook's stated goal of maybe trying to help prevent possible suicides, is there a financial interest here for the company?
Well, I don't know for sure. I find myself wondering if this isn't some sort of almost foot in the door kind of thing where they're picking a very sympathetic case where you almost everyone agrees, yeah, we need to do something to help people who are suicidal. And if we go along with this, what other kinds of interventions, maybe not like legal interventions, will they be more likely to make because we've gotten used to the idea that Facebook data will be applied more and more to what we do in the real world? I'm not really sure whether that is going on here. But one thing that worries me is that you talk about how this might work out better if there were some transparency in terms of the algorithm, and I don't see how they do that because their whole business, Facebook's core business, is generating these algorithms that allow them to learn huge amounts about people from the way they behave. And I find it very unlikely that they're ever going to tell us exactly how this algorithm works because that's their secret sauce. That's
right,
their crown jewels. So we may never find out, and that's not acceptable.
Yeah, no, I agree, Hiawatha, and I think... I hate to say it, I think maybe regulation might be the way to move forward here. Hiawatha Bray, Boston Globe technology writer, thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us was Dr. Mason Marks, research scholar at NYU's Information Law Institute. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Steve Schlossman, co-director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know needs help, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 and the Samaritan Statewide Hotline at 877-870-4673. We'll have those numbers at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Tensions have once again reached a boiling point across the country as yet another...
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. The 2018 was a big year for the Boston-based band Still Gold. They won Live Artist of the Year at the 2018 Boston Music Awards and were named Boston's Best Band by Improper Bostonian. They landed a spot at the Boston Calling Festival, and Still Gold shared the stage with the likes of Eminem, Khalid, and The Roots. But this year, it's fair to say the band's on the verge of something even bigger, the release of their latest album, The New Normal. Yo, this ain't normal. The world is out of sync. We might need the oracle. I'm trying to live good, but this ain't affordable. Making some rapists making me feel uncomfortable. And Donald is both. I remember going from change to hope. Now I'm not knowing which way to go. Years ago. That's a single off the album titled The New Normal Part 1. The whole album drops tomorrow. Still Gold is MC Mo Pope, producer Janosch, the archetype Fulop, as well as backup vocalist Christopher Talken and drummer Jonathan Ullman. Two of the members of the group are with me in studio, Mo Pope and the archetype. Welcome. It's great to have you both.
How you doing?
Hey, man. Thank you for having us.
So you guys have blown up this year, as I mentioned, but Mo, you've been on our show before, and last year you told WBUR that you see Boston as a maybe hostile city to hip-hop performers. Do you still view things that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, well, the thing is that, you know, progression happens, you know, with time. And, you know, I think that those things have happened. Like, progression has definitely happened. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Boston Calling is a huge thing. There mm-hmm. wasn't much local hip-hop put on that. You have venues still not really taking us seriously across the world. You know, people are still looking at hip-hop artists and MCs as like something to be just played on the radio, not actually taken seriously as human beings that live in society, you know, and are creating a high art for people, you know, just like, you know, what Paul and John and Ringo and, you know, George did, you know. So That's what I hope moves on, you know, from there. It progression happens everywhere.
And what do you think is at the core of that for here in Boston?
I mean, I hate to just pop out racism. I think it's ignorance more than anything. It's not just racism. You know, there's a lot of things going on to unpack with why it might be. But at the end of the day, you know, awareness and all those things help. You know, and having certain artists, I mean, it's not like the Latrell Jameses and the Cliff Notes of the world and the Oompas and Dutch Rebels of this city shouldn't have to work hard to try to get a venue to play at. But yet we do, you know. So.
But speaking of venues, you guys had this album announcement at the MFA, the sort of height of high art here in Boston.
Yeah. I mean, And props to the MFA for allowing and realizing that the music deserves its space in those walls, you know. You know, I think that you know, Mo has championed the idea of not taking no for an answer, and also bringing your art to alternative locations, you know, and that's very much in the core of the spirit of the band overall, is trying to find ways of doing what we're gonna do regardless, and doing it maybe in a different, slightly different way. And to have your music listened to in that setting was just kind of a remarkable thing.
It's surreal for me because I love art in all different platforms. There aren't many African American artists who are highlighted or championed in mm-hmm. in any museum, you know, let alone ours. You know, so it's a big deal for me, you know. And then hip hop in and of itself, all of those things factor into why being in the Art of the Americas at the MFA.
George Washington, above you guys,
you know,
right?
It's totally. Like, it was never meant to be there. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't. Like, you know, and I'm glad we were a part of it.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, I think for some people, at its core, hip hop is about being an outsider, and you took it to the most insidery, perhaps one of the most insidery places in the city, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I want to actually listen back to something from your previous album, Torch mm-hmm. Song, yep. 2017. This is The Cost. Let's listen.
Me and mine been on the curb, watching demons doing dirt, smoking leaf but on alert for all of those who out to get us. Got my mind going berserk cause I watch these roaches and critters. Survival is of the fittest every minute, bullets hitting kids, mimicking how they pops did it. With windows tinted, blunt burning, far from finish, inhale. Grimace, hold it in, let it vanish, vanish.
I really love this album, and if I were to note a transition here, it would be... sort of, there is an introspection in Torch Song, if I can say that. And at least what I've heard of the new album feels like there's a more outward political stance. Is that a fair analysis?
Absolutely. I think that in Torch Song there was just this moment of like, you know, what is this world coming to, and how do we play a role in this, and what's happening, what's next, like, you know, whatever. And then with this record, it's more of like, well, this is it. This is like,
this is
we're
how
here.
It is.
Yeah, we're here. Like, you know, it's not like a shock anymore. Nobody's shocked. No one's saying how and why anymore. In fact, in some instances, we're desensitized even to the horrors that are actually happening. And you know, political, yes, you know, but also human. We're living in this world. You know, you don't have to be political really to open your eyes.
Chaos is in the bricks and follows where I go, and when we die, the whole world watch.
Yeah, I think that the phrase political is kind of an interesting one, because it's like anytime music addresses just the sort of realities of life, it's like kind of labeled as political for whatever reason, which, I mean, maybe says something about the climate we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in a highly, you know, politicized climate that's like completely divided, you know, and so if you're talking about what it means to live in that life, then you're making a political record. But, you know, I think honestly, both the last records have been really, in a lot of ways, personal records. You know, the first, you know, Torch Song being sort of a lot of looking inside and trying to figure out, you know, battles inside and how do you kind of come to terms with what the world's becoming. And then this record sort of being like, this is what it is, and this is the outside world, and this is how I'm trying to navigate it.
You're looking at something that we particularly haven't seen in our lifetime. Our parents been through the MLKs and, you know, the JFKs, and, you know, our grandparents went through the civil rights movement, and now we were told that everything's all good. You know, it's all good, but it really is it, you know, and I think a lot of people have been saying that it ain't good for a long time. And a lot of people didn't believe that, and now they're seeing it, you know, in real time, you know. So
I want to hear some more music from your new album, The New Normal. It's a brand new song called Ashes, featuring Oompa and Will Daly. This is a premiere. The full version will be at our website, radioboston.org.
Black kids and crumble the king. I'm a giver. Your lady swiveling when I swing. The tongue often, it's natural. She like when I sing. Got problems. I'm trying to fling them all through a mic. I'm a lover trying harder. I don't care what you like. In the face of race bait, it's crushing stereotypes. Smoking that good, good, whatever. Rocking stuff in the pipe. Trying to change my own bullshit to better my life. Either you with it or you not. Or I'm up in the lights, and it burns like the cross does, disturb the night as it glows on the black face. The breeze, despite the many years of hatred, and wish to eat the fight. Worth every second of my time to bring the light, and then we might find a space to vibe vibrate and use my words as a weapon to shatter your mind state. Peace.
Peace from your ashes. I'll be you and you'll be me. There will be no difference. Let it burn. Get free.
That might seem like an obvious connection here, Ashes. Of course, your last album was Torch Song, and the album art there was a white church on fire. What are you trying to say with this song?
With me, really, we were trying to figure out something that was just incendiary. Like, you know, I don't know what the taste of racism clean off of somebody's lips, you know. But I've got to think of that's what it's probably like, you know. Someone watching a cross burning on the front lawn, what is that like? You know, in reality, like, you know, I don't know it, but my grandfather did.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't that long ago. And that's the thing that people need to really understand.
Learn to hate me. I learned to take all of your flack. 2018, every punch you throw, I'm coming with two back.
For me, mostly, it's just like trying to take these incendiary, very fiery moments and try to turn them into something slightly more positive. You know, I've encased it into a nice little hip hop song, you know. But really what I was thinking about is like, what is fire to me, you know? And that's part of it. That's part of this country's history. So, you know.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the positivity part, because there are some dark themes in there. You say, you know, years ago I got on a boat, never went home. The world is out of sync. Things are not affordable. So for both of you, but I'll start with you, Mo, where do you find hope or positivity here?
You know, progression. Me and my brother are very opposite. We grew up very opposite, you know, from each other, and yet here we are.
What do you mean by opposite? You're motioning to your producer, the archetype, right now.
I mean, he grew up with two parents in the household. He grew up in, you know, a very rural area. I grew up in the projects with a single mother, you know. And, you know, when you have these very polar opposite things, I think that, you know, it's great when people can come together and find some type of positivity in that.
I mean, I feel like, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, the will to continue. It's like you got to find something to kind of fight for, you know, and something to hang your hat on and move with and move forward with. Otherwise, it's just, what's the point? For me, I mean, it's been music and connecting with the community. You know, and that's the thing that for me every day kind of puts a little bit of life, no matter what the news brings, no matter what might be happening on a personal level. There's this lane for me to be able to contribute in. You know, it's the lane I know, you know, but everyone has their own, you know.
And with that being said, just because we're making, you know, hip hop and music political doesn't mean that it has to be downtrodden and sad. Mm-hmm. It could, you know, you could still knock your neck to it. And you could still, like, smile at parts, and you could still, like, find a common ground in certain sections, because we're kind of living it. We're all living it together regardless, like, you know, so.
And at the end of the day, like, a lot of people tell us the music we've made has been sort of the thing that helps them. That's the biggest compliment we can possibly get, because it means that what we've done is sort of help other people find a way to continue on and kind of find a little hope in the whole thing.
And on that note, let's hear more of Ashes. This is Oompa's verse of the song.
We all gotta be tough. That pressure on rusty pipes is surely to make it bust. You human or you human? What kind of colors do you breathe? What color is your air? What kind of water do you need? You got bills, you got family that you don't always with. Got any regrets, any trauma you feel stuck with? Me too, it's human. Let's take it back to like preschool. No parents, no paychecks. And tell me, would we be cool? It's likely, in fact, to keep the status quo.
Do you guys think there's a Boston sound, and how do you capture that?
I think I've been in music for quite a bit, and the sound has changed. The good thing about our sound is that none of us sound alike. You know, it's like, that's the coolest thing about it.
The thing that ties it all together is I think Boston has a spirit, and that's the thing, you know, because the sound has grown so much over the course of the last two decades. You know, it used to be very easy to label Boston as, like, it was this thing, you know, especially in the genres in particular. Like, that's, I just don't think the case anymore, sonically speaking. But spirit-wise, it's like, this city is a hardworking city. You know what I mean? It's like, for as highbrow as it's getting, it's still a blue collar city. You know what I mean? And people put in the work here, you know, and it shows in the music, I think, across the board. You know what I mean? Like, projects that come out of this city elevate, you know, and they elevate the work we have to do because we got to keep up with them. You know what I mean? And so the idea is that, like, there's this spirit of, like, constant pushing and trying to push everything forward and elevate the music that I think that's the thing that to me is the common thread.
So in terms of pushing the envelope, I mentioned that you guys were named the best live artist of the year by the Boston Music Awards, and you're having this big album release party tomorrow night at the Oberon. What can people expect there?
Oh, mayhem.
and a lot of good vibes.
Yeah, good vibes. Positive energy.
Positive mayhem.
MC Mo Pope and producer Janosch the Architect Fullup of the band Still Gold, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Their new album comes out tomorrow. It's called The New Normal, and you can go to their album release party at the Oberon in Boston tomorrow night. There's more information about tickets to that mayhem and an exclusive full version of Ashes at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Join us again tomorrow. This is Radio Boston, and I'm Jamie Bologna.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.